The moment the temple doors closed behind them, Mintaka and Merikara dropped their pretense of resigned innocence. "Have you made the arrangements, Holy Mother?" Mintaka demanded eagerly. "Have no fear, daughter. All is in readiness." The priestess's brown eyes sparkled with amusement. Clearly she was enjoying this escapade, a break from the tranquil routine of temple life. "I took the liberty of slipping a mild sleeping draught into the eunuch's wine," she giggled. "I hope you'll not think I've overstepped myself, and that you'll forgive me." Mintaka kissed her smooth, pale cheek. "I'm sure Hathor will be as proud of you as I am." The priestess led them to a cell where all the items that Mintaka had requested were laid out for them. They dressed hastily in the rough peasant garments and covered their heads with woolen shawls. Then, carrying the leather pouches slung across their shoulders, they followed the high priestess through the maze of corridors. The temple backed onto the Nile, and they became aware of the gentle swish of the river current against the outer walls, growing louder ahead of them. At last they stepped out through a low doorway into the sunshine, and onto the jetty where a large dhow was moored. "The captain has been paid with the gold you gave me, and he knows where to go. All the other items you asked for are stowed in your cabin on board," she said. "You know what to tell Zuka," Mintaka said, and the old woman giggled again. "I am sure that Hathor will forgive me such an insignificant falsehood. It is in such a good cause." As the pair jumped down onto the deck of the dhow, the crew, who'd been dozing in the shade, scrambled to their feet and rushed to set the lateen sail. Without waiting for orders, the captain steered out into the main flow of the current and turned the bows downstream, heading for the delta. For the rest of that day, Mintaka and Merikara stayed in the tiny cabin, taking no chance that they might be recognized from the shore or from a passing riverboat. In the late afternoon, the dhow moored briefly against the east bank, and two armed men came aboard carrying heavy sacks. Immediately the dhow captain hoisted the sail again, and they pressed on with all speed downriver. The two men came to the cabin and prostrated themselves before Mintaka. "May all the gods love you, Majesty," said the bigger of the two, a bearded Hyksos with a large nose and strong features. "We are your dogs. We came as soon as we received your summons."
"Look!"
Mintaka smiled with pleasure to see his well-remembered face, then turned to the other man.
"And surely this is your son, Lokka?"
He seemed as big and doughty as his father.
"You're both well met and welcome. You lot served my father well. Will you and your son do the same for me?"
She spoke in the Hyksosian language. "With our lives, mistress," they told her.
"I will have hard employment for you once we go ashore, but until then, rest and prepare your weapons."
The dhow captain selected one of the many mouths of the delta, where the current slowed and meandered through swamps and lagoons, over which hovered clouds of waterfowl. Darkness fell before they reached the open sea, but the dhow captain steered his craft unerringly through the shallows and the hidden sandbars, until the last miasma of the swamps was blown away on the clean salt airs of the Mediterranean. The two girls came up on deck.
"Just about now, Zuko will realize that we've flown,"
Mintaka smiled at Merikara.
"I wonder what he'll tell Nefer. That we are safely locked up in the temple under the wing of the High Priestess? I hope so."
With a half-moon in the sky, they sailed out of the confined waterways and felt the surge of the open sea lift the deck beneath their feet. As soon as he had made his offing and there was deep water under his hull, the captain turned eastward and hugged the coast throughout the night. In the dawn, Mintaka and Merikara stood in the bows, huddled in their shawls for warmth. They stared south at the low, bleak desert shore to their right.
"To think that Nefer is only a few leagues out there," Mintaka whispered. "I feel as though I could reach out my hand to touch him. Meryn is there too, only a little further to the east. What a surprise they'd have to know that we are so close. Oh, my heart yearns for Nefer. I pray every hour to Horus and Hathor to keep him safe.
You no longer hate him, then?
Merikara asked.
I never did.
Mintaka denied hotly, then hesitated.
Well, perhaps for a moment, and only for a very little. I know just how you feel,
Merikara assured her.
At times they can be so stubborn and bull-headed and...
She sought for a word to describe it.
So male.
Yes,
Mintaka agreed.
That's it exactly. Like children. I suppose we must forgive them, for they cannot help themselves.
During the rest of that day and the following night, they sailed eastward along the coast, through the Khalig al-Tina, and along the string of islands and sandbars that enclose the vast lagoon of the Sabhet el-Badawil. The next morning, the dhow edged in towards the beach at El Arish, and as soon as the water was waist-deep, the two bodyguards, Lok and Lokka, carried the women ashore and waded back to the boat to fetch the baggage. The small party stood and watched the crew of the dhow row off, then set sail and head back out to sea for the return to Egypt and the Delta.
"Well, we've done it,"
said Merikara uncertainly. Despite Mintaka's company, she was feeling vulnerable and alone.
"But what do we do now?"
She sounded close to tears.
"I'll send Locke to find transport for us," said Mintaka.
And then, to give her comfort and a little more confidence, she went on to explain to Merikara,
"Nefer might have stopped us going southward through the desert to find my Uncle Tonka, but we've outwitted him."
She smiled more gaily than her spirits dictated, for even she was more aware than Merikara of their invidious position.
"Just think how furious Nefer and Meron would be if only they knew."
They laughed together, and Mintaka went on.
"Here we are, in the rear of Naja's advancing army, and the road between Beersheba and Ismailia lies a very few leagues south of us. When Locke finds a cart or wagon, we can lose ourselves in the baggage train of Naja's army, hide out among the camp followers until we reach the headquarters of Uncle Tonka."
It was not quite as easy to find transport as Mintaka had made it sound. The quartermasters of Naja's army had been ahead of them, and had seized wagons and horses, as well as food and provisions from the local populace. In the end, they had to settle for a string of 5 decrepit donkeys, and they had to pay dearly for these, with 2 heavy gold rings and 2 of silver. The animals were barely able to support the weight of even the 2 women, let alone their bodyguards, so they walked most of the rugged path southwards, until on the 3rd day after landing, they topped a rise and saw in the valley below them the tail of the army of Pharaoh Naja. This great host filled the main east-to-west road in both directions as far as the eye could see, and the dust it raised sullied the sky like the smoke from a forest fire. They went down to join it, and found themselves in the baggage train. They fell in with the long caravan of wagons and pack animals. Mintaka and Merikara kept their heads and faces covered, and in their dusty, bedraggled clothing excited little notice. Locke and Lokka chaperoned them closely and discouraged the attentions of any other travellers. The rate of march was of the slowest, so even on the poor donkeys they were moving a little faster than the rest of the cavalcade. And, like a scrap of flotsam in the mighty river, they drifted forward towards the head. As they went, they passed every type and condition of humanity, beggars and bawds, merchants and water-carriers, barbers, coppersmiths and carpenters, troubadours and junglers. There were captains, splendid in the gold of valour, driving their chariots furiously through the throng, lashing out of their path the limping cripples on their crutches, and the army women with their bastards at the breast, feeding on the march, toddlers whining at their skirts. Mintaka and Merikara kept up the best speed the wretched donkeys could manage, and they camped that first night under the stars, surrounded by the campfires, the hubbub and stench of this immense agglomeration of humanity. In the dawn, as soon as it was light enough to see the road underfoot, they set off again. Before noon, they'd caught up with the rearguard of the main army. The marching companies of spearmen and the ranks of archers with bows unstrung, the battalions of slingers singing their marching songs in the barbaric language of the Western Islands. Next, they passed the long lines of the horses of the Remount Division, 20 to a string being led behind the fodder wagons and the water carts. Mintaka marvelled at the numbers. It did not seem possible that there were so many animals in all Egypt. The soldiers looked at the two women, and not even their shoddy dress or the voluminous shawls wrapped round their heads could hide their youth and grace from such discerning eyes. They called suggestive compliments and lewd invitations as they passed, but the discipline of their officers and the stern presence of Lok and Lokka kept them from any further advances. That evening, they kept on travelling after the main army had encamped, and after sunset they came upon a large zareba of poles and thorn bushes just off the road. This had been set up in an easily defended defile of low hills. The entrance was heavily guarded, and there was much activity around it, the marching and countermarching of the sentries, the scurrying of servants and orderlies, and the coming and goings of chariots, driven by officers of the Red. Above the gate of the stockade flew the gonfalon that Mintaka recognized at once. On it was depicted the severed head of a wild boar with its tongue lolling from the corners of its tusked jaws. "This is the man we're looking for," Mintaka whispered to Merikara.
"But how do we get to see him?"
Merikara asked doubtfully, eyeing the sentries. They made their own rudimentary camp a little further down the road, but within sight of the gates of the regimental headquarters of General Pren, Centurion of the Red, and the commander of the rearguard of the Pharaonic Army. From one of the leather saddlebags, Mintaka brought out the precious oil lamp that had so far survived the journey, and by its light she wrote a short message on a scrap of papyrus parchment. It was addressed to Uncle Bear and signed, "From Your Little Cricket." The two women washed the dust from their faces, dressed each other's hair, and shook out their chitons. Then, hand in hand to give each other courage, they approached the gate of the stockade. The sergeant of the guard saw them coming and stepped in front of them to head them off. "Come on, you two juicy pieces of prong bait. You know better than to come flaunting your joy clefts hereabouts. Get away with you."
"You look like a good and kind man," Mintaka told him primly. "Would you allow any ruffian to talk to your own daughters in that coarse fashion?"
The sergeant checked and gawked at her. She spoke the Hyksos language in the cultured tones and accents of the aristocracy. He lifted his lantern and shone the light upon them. Their dress was common, but their features made him draw breath sharply. These were clearly young women of high rank. In fact, their faces were disturbingly familiar, even though he could not immediately place them. "Forgive me, ladies," he mumbled. "Mistook you for..." He broke off, and Mintaka smiled graciously.
"Of course you are forgiven. Will you deliver a message for us to Centurion Pren?"
She proffered the rolled parchment. The sergeant hesitated a moment before he took it. "I'm sorry, but I'll have to ask you to wait here until I have an instruction from him." He came hurrying back within a very short time. "My ladies, I'm desolated to have kept you waiting. Please follow me." He led them to a pavilion of coloured linen in the centre of the stockade. There was another short delay as he whispered to the junior officer in charge of the entrance. Then they were led through into the tent. The interior was sparsely furnished, and the floor was covered by animal skins, oryx, zebra, and leopard. On these, a man was sitting cross-legged with maps and scrolls spread about him, and a wooden platter on his lap, containing grilled ribs and a lump of durra bread. He looked up as the girls entered. His face was gaunt, his cheeks sunken, and even the ribbons in his beard could not disguise the fact that it was more grey than black. A leather patch covered one eye. He scowled at them.
"Uncle Tonka."
Mintaka stepped into the lamplight and threw back her head shawl. The man came to his feet slowly and stared at her. Then suddenly he grinned, and his single eye gleamed.
"I did not think it possible!"
He embraced her and lifted her off her feet.
"I heard that you'd deserted us and gone over to the enemy."
When he put her down again, and she'd partially recovered from this display of affection, she gasped,
"That is what I've come to speak to you about, Uncle Tonka."
"Who's this with you?"
He glanced at Merikara, then blinked his one good eye.
"By Seth's foul breath, I know you."
"It's the Princess Merikara,"
Mintaka told him.
"Nadja's runaway wife. They will be pleased to have you back."
Pren chuckled. "Have the two of you eaten?" Then, without waiting for a reply, he shouted to his servants to bring more meat and bread and wine. The two girls covered their faces again while they were being served, but once the servants had gone, Mintaka sat close to Pren on the side of his good ear and dropped her voice so that they could not be overheard by a listener outside the tent walls. He heard her out silently, but his expression changed as she described to him in detail the events of that terrible night when her father and all her brothers had died in the burning galley on the river at Balasphura. Mintaka thought she saw a tear gleam in the corner of his eye as she went on, but she knew that such a show of weakness was not possible in a centurion of the Red. Pren turned away his face, and when he looked back at her the tear was gone, and she knew that she'd been mistaken. When at last she finished speaking, Pren said simply,
"I loved your father almost as much as I love you, little cricket. But what you're proposing is treason."
He was silent a moment longer, and then he sighed.
"All this I'll have to think on. But in the meantime, you can't return whence you came. It's much too risky. You must stay under my care, both of you, until this affair is resolved."
When they protested, he overrode them brusquely.
"It's not a request. It's an order."
He thought for a moment.
"I'll have you disguised as a pair of my pretty boys. That'll cause little comment, for all my men know that I enjoy a slice of rump almost as much as a cut of breast."
"Can I at least send a message to Nefertiti?"
Mintaka pleaded.
"That also is too great a risk. Have patience, it'll not be for long. Nadja is poised on the heights of Khatmia. Within days he'll begin the march on Ismailia. The battle will be decided before the full moon of Osiris begins to wane." His voice dropped to a growl. "And I will be forced to a decision."